Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1257 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd med mig, Ronny Berggren. I detta avsnitt samtalar jag med den konservativa amerikanske politiska analytikern Justin White om gårdagens stormning av USAs kongressbyggnad, Donald Trumps och republikanernas framtid. Varmt välkomna. Justin White, welcome.
Ronnie, it's good to be with you again, and happy new year to you and your listeners.
Yeah, to you too. You know, yesterday was the new year didn't start that good in the United States, in your country. And a lot of things happened yesterday. And basically, the Capitol Hill, the Capitolium was occupied. Your initial thoughts about the incident yesterday?
Well, you know, there's some people that are declaring that we need a redo on the new year, I think, at this point. So I have to say that as a whole, I'm pretty perplexed and frustrated and disappointed with what I saw yesterday. And obviously, we'll get into the details as we go on. But what we saw yesterday was not America at its best. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, and basically this was the first time since I think 1814 that the Capitol has been breached like that, and that 200 years ago it was the British, and yesterday it was the so-called patriots, I assume.
Well, I don't know that I would consider them patriots. As a descendant of one of the signers of the Declaration, I think that this unfortunately looked more like a peasant uprising, not to be ugly, of the European variety of so many centuries ago, and equally unsuccessful, rather than the thoughtful and intentional revolutions that brought us, you know, this great republic that we've long held, and many places like it, you know, over the next 200 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was, I don't even know that I can say it's well-intentioned. I think that it might have been born of a legitimate sense of frustration underlying it, but it was definitely poorly thought out and overly aggressive and indecent. I'll use the word indecent.
Yeah, but let's start from the beginning and take it step by step. You know, on November 3rd, you had an election, a presidential election that Joe Biden basically won. It took a couple of days for the votes to be counted, but after that had happened in the key states, then basically all the media said that he has won, and he basically had won. You know, Donald Trump, he claimed that there were a lot of frauds, and a lot of investigations were made, and the basic conclusion among the investigators and among the courts was that no, Joe Biden did not win this election because of fraud. But the supporters of Donald Trump, a lot of them, they still believe that this election was stolen. And, you know, you had the Stop the Steal march in Washington, D.C. in December. And Donald Trump has basically said that the election was stolen. If you believe in me and if you voted for me, you have to keep rooting for me, basically. Can we say that was the start point of the things that happened yesterday?
Absolutely. I think that's a pretty excellent summation. And I would say further that, and I always want to give as balanced approach as I can, because I do feel like there is a lot of room for reasonable people to debate in the animating contest of liberty, as our founding fathers called, democracy. And to that point, that while there were incidental instances of voter fraud, and there absolutely were occasions where it did happen and verifiably, the numerical value of those fraudulent ballots is, even if it were multiplied by 10, insufficient to have actually driven the outcome of the election as a whole, not least of which because there were voter fraud elements on both sides that we've now documented. Both Republicans falsifying ballots for Trump and Democrats falsifying ballots for Biden, and possibly some people just trying to cause trouble in general.
Yeah.
In a country with 330 million people, you're going to have quite a number of jerks, frankly, but it's not statistically significant. So I want to address that first and foremost. Secondly, the half-baked conspiracy theories, and in particular some of the actions of the Trump-affiliated attorneys like Lynn Wood, and some of the comments have just been shockingly insane, frankly. from claims that Jeffrey Epstein is still alive to, Mike Pence being a, child pornographer. I mean, just really outlandish things that don't deserve, frankly, our discussing them, but only in the context of this is the level of unreasonable that some of the people have gotten to. It's perfectly fine to say that you disagree with someone's policies, or even that you think there may be cause for concern over their decency or credibility or potential even corruption. But it's another to talk about dead people being alive and people being engaged in monstrous activities of which there's zero evidence of. And this is the fringe now. And unfortunately, for your listeners and at home and abroad, one of the struggles within the American system, is that we really are the third largest nation on earth after China and India in terms of population. And because of our infrastructure network as well, it's not that difficult to get, 4,000 kilometers away from California to Washington, D.C. within a day or two if one is deeply inclined to do so. And so in an instance like what we saw yesterday, in as much as I find it to be appalling and disappointing and certainly not in the best keeping with the standards that I was raised to believe and uphold, while also still being a vocal activist, as you know, and your longtime listeners will know, that it doesn't take a lot to find a few hundred or maybe even a few thousand people in a nation of 330 million who are genuinely unhinged. And I think that's what we saw yesterday with some people who represent the fringe of the fringe, in many cases, engaged in behavior that was just beyond the pale.
Yeah, but before we get into that, since Trump has, basically preached these conspiracy theories, a majority of his supporters and a majority of the Republicans, they basically believe in this narrative that the election was stolen. I think it was 70% of the Republicans believe that something was wrong with the election. So he must have been a very effective communicator with this message.
Well, again, because of the polarization of America, and to his credit, Donald Trump is very effective at getting his opinion out there, largely through Twitter, but he has his other mechanisms as well, and his surrogates, like folks like former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, et cetera. And I will say that an unfortunate, frankly, number of Republicans in this country are giving time and space to things that are pushing the facts well beyond their reality. Again, I think there is legitimate cause for concern over some of the potential abilities at fraud that exist due to the technology, but not that have been proven, and also just the lack of voter ID and some of these other issues that we earnestly need to address in America for election security and safety moving forward. But it's one thing to discuss election integrity, and it's another to state that an election is in fact stolen when there's no credible evidence that that is true. And I feel like too few, and there are a number of notable senators, such as very conservative Republican Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, and even former Republican nominee for president Mitt Romney, who's a senator from Utah now. Have both been rather strong and bold in pushing back against some of the president's more outlandish assertions. But on the whole, when you think of the 53 Republican U.S. senators that currently sit in the U.S. Senate, although that number will be changing over the next couple of days, that you would expect to see dozens and dozens of senators, and it has really been limited to they and U.S. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska has been pretty outspoken. And there have been three or four others who have weighed in, fairly intelligently and thoughtfully, as well as some House members. But by and large, unfortunately, I would say the majority of Republican office holders have been silent, and silence is too often viewed as consent. And frankly, a number of them have waved the fan, fan the flames. Most notably, the 2016 runner-up, Ted Cruz, also a very prominent new Republican by the name of Josh Hawley from Missouri, and they've really tried to stand out on this issue of rejection and stop the steal and all this sort of thing, and it's a bad look for them, frankly.
Yeah, but basically this idea of a stolen election was what made like 100,000 people. I don't know how many came to the rally yesterday, but it was a lot of people at least. And they have one thing in common: they believe that the election was stolen. And Donald Trump held a speech, and he said basically, well, he said that the election was stolen, and this is our last stand. We have to, we have to. Convince Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the electoral votes from the states. We have to make Mike Pence deny the certifying of the election result and stop him from declaring Joe Biden president. So that was basically the motivation for the rally yesterday. And after that, things just if we start with that, was it justified for Trump to hold a rally like this? Did he have the right to do that, or was it like? Yeah.
I mean, I would say that it's one thing to, have a rally and address your supporters as the sitting president. I think that in and of itself on its face is fine. I even think it would have been fine for him to discuss, things like election integrity issues that have certainly been highlighted in this matter, and possibly even to call for further investigation. I think would not necessarily have been outside the bounds, so to speak. But when he's doing things like calling on the vice presidency to assent, Vice President Pence to essentially stand in the way of the process, it pushes the boundary and steps over the line into actively asserting, something that's just simply not true, first and foremost. And I think we have to judge the president fairly harshly, regardless, because one of two things must be true, right? Either he knew exactly what he was doing and that it was thoughtful and intentional and reckless disregard for our traditions and the rule of law, in which case what he did is arguably impeachable and grounds for removal, or alternatively, he cares so little about the consequences of his words that he thinks that this is something that he can do for fun and that it won't have consequences, which shows that he's unfit in the manner of conducting the office with its dignity and its integrity and its propriety. So he's either guilty of being, vicious, or he's guilty of being an incompetent fool. And in either case, he's unfit to be the president, unfortunately.
Yeah, but before we go into the details here, I would say that most Trump supporters, most people who go to Trump rallies, they are peaceful. And when I watch Trump rallies, they sing, they are friendly, they don't turn into violence or anything like that. Is that your description? Is that how you would describe, the Trump rallies too? Peaceful, basically.
Absolutely. I want to make a very clear distinction between those who voted for the president, of which there were over 70 million Americans who did in this most recent election, and even those that support him a little bit further to the point that they would go to a rally or put out a yard sign or wear a Make America Great Again hat. There are many decent folks from every walk and stripe of life, every race, creed, color, gay and straight, black and white, old and young, rural and urban. You'll literally see a cross-section of America at these rallies. But there is a subset, and I do think it deserves a little bit of further scrutiny, that because of the inflammatory nature of some of the things Trump says and the way that he says them, equally importantly, that there he does draw out in a way that very few politicians in the modern era, segment of people who, frankly, might better be served to be left at home. And again, in a nation of 330 million people, a 1/100th of 1%, right, is still, 330,000 people. And it's important to remember that, even at the true margins of the margins, there's just a sheer volume. And Trump, unfortunately,
not only doesn't discourage, but it sometimes actively encourages these people to engage in the political process, which is their right under our democratic, you know, constitution and methodologies. But frankly, they do not represent a meaningful element, and nor is their voice really a welcome or necessary one at the table in this country.
Yeah, but my point is, when I watched the rally and the people marching towards the Capitolium from the rally where Trump spoke, everything I watched was a peaceful movement, and then some people tried to get into Capitolium. So I would say that most people, even in that crowd, were peaceful. So my question before we come into the real details is, who do you think, who broke basically the rules and started to engage with police? Do you have any theories about that?
I think that, you know, like in any, you know, large crowds, and there's even a reference to it in psychology, the rule of large crowds, you're going to have so many different sub ideologies, especially when you're talking about a crowd that was legitimately, you know, 100,000 and possibly two or three times that size, right? It could have well been, nearly a quarter to a half a million people. You know, statistically speaking, if 1% of those people decide to do something, you know, significantly, that's literally thousands of individuals, which is certainly enough to at least overwhelm in a semi-peaceful slash mob style, you know, not outright civil war style violence, but you know, human wave kind of, you know, our 50 to 100 Capitol policemen that would be at any, you know, general area would be, you know, difficult to hold back 4,000 or 5,000 civilians without engaging in just, you know, pell-mell opening fire, which of course would not have been appropriate either. And so, you know, that's the problem. You know, there's an old Irish expression, beware of raising the devil because you'll have to pay him. And unfortunately, some of Trump's rhetoric is so impassioned and so charged that it's not unreasonable to realize that some of the more agitated, perhaps frankly less well-grounded people in a crowd could be stirred. Sort of the argument that Oliver Wendell Holmes, our rather famous former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court many decades ago, said that free speech is the hallmark of America, but you don't have a right to yell fire in a crowded theater because of what it will set off. And I do think that the president at minimum is guilty of encouraging inflammatory rhetoric that plays on the sometimes fragile emotions of people at the margins of society. And in the same way that I have problems with some of the comments that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the more flamboyant members of the U.S. House of Representatives, sometimes uses, where she says that we need to, you know, gather up the wealthy and throw them all in prison. I mean, that's certainly not appropriate rhetoric either. And yet, you know, they engage in what they would tell you later is, you know, oh, I was being hyperbolic, or I was, you know, just kind of playing to the moment. Well, but the problem is when, as we saw, you know, two or three years ago, following another election that Americans had problems with, but that was more Republican in nature, there was a gentleman who came to the congressional baseball game and shot the place up, nearly killing four members of Congress. So, you know, the words of our leaders matter, and I think that that's something that even as a vociferous conservative who actually agrees with the overwhelming majority of the underlying policy principles that the Trump administration and its many hundreds and thousands of employees and staffers, you know, pushed, the president's rhetoric has moved beyond that which is presidential and dignified, and it's a real shame.
Yeah. If you go into the details, then I know that you had friends inside the Capitolium who basically lived through these horrible hours. Can you tell me about what they have told you about the things inside? What happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, from my time in Washington and working in politics across the U.S., of course, I, you know, helped to train and give jobs to a number of folks who worked, you know, for me and with me over the many years, and of course, a number of those people are now staffers in the halls of, you know, the U.S. House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate or other areas of our federal government. And, you know, I reached out, to get some perspective. A couple of them actually messaged me, because what happened is, once the initial shock of the thing happened and they broke in and there was some, you know, low scale violence, I'll say, you know, breaking of certain things, stealing, et cetera. They would go into the congressional office areas as well, and they were doing things like kicking in doors, and there were legitimately staffers, some of whom were my friends, literally hiding for fear of what it might escalate to. I won't say that any of them you know, came under fire or anything like this. It wasn't quite as violent as all that. But there's always that fear of the escalation that, you know, what starts out as smashing and basically looting, you know, can escalate into further violence. And so there was a lot of fear and uncertainty. Obviously, the blunt reality is, because a lot of these jobs are frankly not that well paying, many of the staffers are no more than college students, and, you know, they're not prepared for this, and they certainly don't deserve this kind of treatment. They're just there trying to help, you know, push forward the small elements of our government, and taking calls from constituents and sending out emails and making sure that the elderly are getting their, you know, Medicare or Social Security payments. And they're just decent, hardworking Americans who are, you know, serving in the different areas of government. And they were legitimately made to be afraid yesterday, and including people that I know are shrinking violence, right? This is not, you know, some, you know, individual over in the corner who's just scared of their own shadow. These are grown people who are wise and thoughtful and capable individuals to hold many of these positions. And in one particular case that I heard about, one of my friends who's been a Capitol Hill staffer for nearly a decade now, and he's in his late 30s, he and his entire office staff were forced to run, not just stroll or be patiently aware. They were forced to run surrounded by armed guards from where they were located, as though they were being, you know, potentially targeted by snipers. And this is not the kind of behavior that is appropriate. America does have challenges, and some of them, frankly think are very significant and deserve some really, really stern attention and even stern language on some of the policy positions I feel are appropriate. But it should never come down to making Capitol Hill staffers and interns genuinely afraid for their safety. That's uncalled for.
Yeah. Did they tell you anything about, you know, what people they saw inside? Was it like, what kind of people was it, according to them?
So, you know, here again, I think, you know, it's hard to paint with a simple broad brush. We know that, unfortunately, the first known casualty was a woman who's actually a former U.S. Air Force veteran for 14 years. So someone who served this country with some distinction and dignity for, you know, a good portion of her life. And she was actually shot and killed by Capitol Hill police. So I don't know if she had mental stability issues, possibly from time in combat zones. You know, I don't want to make too much conjecture, but I do know that that's a all too common occurrence. And I am sad for her family that would have happened, but I can't say that I approve of her behavior. And, you know, I do know that in most cases, these seem to be predominantly, you know, young to middle-aged working class folks, both white and black, but leaning more, you know, white, more rural, more Republican, but also more activated by Donald Trump's rhetoric. I wouldn't say these represent the traditional, normal, you know, standard Republican rally folk that you might have seen out at rallies for George W. Bush or Bob Dole or Mike Huckabee, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. There's definitely a bit of a working class revolt element to it as well. And there's nothing wrong with a little healthy skepticism of would-be elites in power. I think that's part of how America was founded. But I do think that you have to be tempered in the, you know, much along the lines of Martin Luther King Jr. or the Olive Branch Petition. The American Revolution was not started by a bunch of bomb throwers. It was started by, you know, wise men who'd had enough and who had sought all the legal and professional methods for addressing their grievances and were pushed literally by the actions of the King to revolution almost against their will.
Yeah.
It was not just throwing rocks through people's windows.
No, that's true. But what would you say about, you know, afterwards, it took like 3 hours before the Capitol was safe. You know, the SWAT teams arrived and I think the National Guard was deployed. But how could this happen? I heard there is a rumor that, or it's not a rumor, it's a fact basically, that the mayor of Washington, D.C. wanted to deploy the National Guard. But I think this is true, that Trump said no the day before. And then you just basically had the state police there and they had no chance against this, you know, this huge crowd.
Yeah, that's precisely right. I mean, because, of course, you know, we want to preserve the ability for Americans to legitimately protest and scream even and yell and these kind of, you know, harsh words get exchanged. And that's certainly not the best behavior in the world, but it can be understandable and forgiven, admittedly. But when it crosses the line into, you know, mayhem, which frankly some of the protests this summer did as well, and people were injured unnecessarily on both sides, both law enforcement professionals and citizens, and in both cases it was inappropriate. And so I do believe that in the interest of the limiting, and unfortunately it didn't stop, but in the interest of limiting bodily harm and death, I think that the Capitol Hill police made a judgment to more or less stand aside as long as there was minimal property damage and that there was no, you know, threats to sheer and utter, you know, violence against, you know, people. And so we saw a lot of, you know, door kicking and disruption and disrespect, and even some low-level looting from some congressional offices, and definitely some outspoken disturbances. But, you know, it never reached the threat of, again, kind of a true civil war-like atmosphere with guns and bombs and bullets and, you know, these kinds of things. So there is to be grateful for at this point, I guess.
Yeah, one more thing before we return to Donald Trump and his behavior is that, you know, I would also like to say that it's a big difference between these people and Antifa, because Antifa basically, they jump on everyone and they loot and they destroy the whole city. That did not happen.
Correct. Like, I do want to make it clear that while I do think that these people that we're specifically talking about, these few thousand people who were a part of a much larger rally, definitely pushed the envelope one or two steps further than I think is either practical or decent. You know, at the end of the day, they the level of physical property damage that they committed would have, you know, been in the thousands of dollars, not in the millions of dollars. And that while they made people feel uncomfortable and possibly even genuinely afraid, it wasn't as though they took hostages or killed anyone or beat people within an inch of their life, you know, hospitalized, et cetera, which of course has happened repeatedly at some of the Antifa activities throughout the last year. So while I don't want to be seen as providing cover, if you will, for this kind of inappropriate behavior, it is a level below what Antifa, if not two or three, what Antifa has done at times.
Yeah.
Although I also want to clarify that not all the Black Lives Matter movement is Antifa as well. And so it's important to recognize that while Black Lives Matter, and this is something where, again, I think the president can be chastised, in the same way that we should rightfully chastise Black Lives Matter activists for not policing Antifa and their violence and their damage and their disrespect. And I do think that we can hold Black Lives Matter organizers accountable for that, and should, because they're the ones stirring the pot, so to speak. And you have to take responsibility when you set off an activity. By the same notion, the president's rhetoric went above and beyond that of a thoughtful rebuke or a call to democratic action, and was traipsing into the realm of conspiracy theory and incitement to riot. And unfortunately, that is part of what happened because of it.
Yeah, and you know, he made a response. He wrote something on Twitter, please calm down, and he made a short video message where he said, like, calm down, but the election was stolen, but calm down and go home. Basically, that was what he said. So he did not sound like convincing to, you know, say, calm down for real and, you know, stop this violence. He was not convincing.
Well, that's exactly correct. It had the mark of the child who's, you know, grabbed up by the teacher in the schoolyard and forced to apologize, but it doesn't come from the heart. And to the point that the people who needed to hear it most probably heard it not at all and just discounted it. And at that point, it's also apologizing for burning down your buddy's house, you know, kind of thing. It's like, well, I hear you, but also I'm still without a house.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I found very, not surprising really, but very, very strange, you know, Mike Pence is Donald Trump's most loyal cabinet member, I would say. And Mike Pence has basically protected Donald Trump from everything. And yesterday, Mike Pence, he sent a message where he said that I will confirm Joe Biden as the next president because that is my duty to the Constitution. And after that, Donald Trump basically tweeted that Mike Pence has betrayed us. And, you know, that's like burning a bridge to a very good friend.
It is. And on a personal level, it's disappointing. I'm sure that Mike Pence is troubled by this, because I know that Mike Pence is, above all things, a conservative. And, you know, while there may be room to debate him on policy positions that he holds, both as an American and even as a Republican at times, I don't think anyone has ever accused Mike Pence of being un-American or behaving in a way that is shameful. And I think that he is personally upset, probably. And I know Vice President Pence reasonably well. I helped him get elected to Congress when he was in Indiana. And I know him to be a man of deep conviction, you know, regardless of the issue. And he's not afraid to disagree with people. And that's okay. But I think that this is well beyond what he would consider to be appropriate as well.
Yeah, but at the moment, Donald Trump doesn't really have any friends left. You know, a lot of people have left his cabinet, and basically, I assume maybe he has Rudy Giuliani and his personal lawyers, but, you know, his friends, they are gone. What will happen now, these two coming weeks?
Well, so that's an excellent question, and I've been asked this both privately and through some other, you know, back channels of folks who apparently value my opinion for whatever reason. And, you know, what I said, and it holds true, I think, is that if the president basically hunkers down, keeps his mouth closed, then I think the storm will blow over, although it will definitely leave a memory, and he'll kind of pass ignominiously from the stage. But I do think that if he does anything to further stoke the fires or prod the outrage, that I do believe it is possible, not certain, but I do actually believe that it is possible and even probable that the 25th Amendment, which allows the cabinet to remove the president for unfitness for duty, could be invoked. And Vice President Mike Pence, in that instance, from a legal standpoint, would serve out the remainder of the, you know, 10 or 15 days of the term, depending on when such an event would happen.
How you know, likely is that?
Like I said, I think the deciding factor is Donald Trump's further behavior. I don't believe that they'll do it as punishment, but if they feel like they have no choice to stop an ongoing behavior pattern that was exhibited, unfortunately, yesterday, I think it actually becomes very likely, not least of which because it does not require unanimous. It merely requires that the vice president consent to a majority of the cabinet. Or it does require unanimity on the cabinet if the vice president objects. So those are two options. But I do believe that Mike Pence is troubled enough by what happened that if it happened again, in an interest of both protecting and preserving our country and also his own personal reputation and legacy as the vice president, I believe he would step in regrettably and without any joy, but I do believe that he could be trusted, frankly, to step in and will. And perhaps he may make that clear very privately to the president. And perhaps that may be what is needed to calm the waters for the remaining 2 weeks.
Yeah. You know, I have been a long supporter of Donald Trump and his presidency. I think he has done a lot of good things, and he has accomplished a lot of things that other Republicans has not. But, you know, after the election, a lot of things have changed. And my question is, what do you think about how do you think Trump's behavior these last 2 months will affect his legacy?
I have to say, unfortunately, I believe that, you know, as you and I have seen, and I'm sure some of your long-term listeners, George W. Bush has had a bit of a revival, not to say that he has reached a level of belovedness. Certainly the Democrats still kind of chuckle or poke fun or take shots at him where they can. But I will say that George W. Bush's reputation has arisen pretty meaningfully in the nearly dozen years since he left the office. And I would say that Donald Trump will probably not have a similar outcome. I suspect his will be more akin to that of Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, in that he will go and he will just sort of be politely forgotten and maybe talked about in grumbles and with a lot of people glad that it's over.
Yeah, but you know, I basically supported Donald Trump because I consider him to be a Republican and someone who championed Republican issues. What do you say now about the future of the Republican Party?
Well, and I don't want you to get caught out on a limb either, you know, Ronnie, because I too, you know, I've made no bones about the fact that I voted for Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton. Yeah. You know, with full faith at the time, not as much in his rhetoric, but in the principles that underlie him. And frankly, Mike Pence shored those up for me because I knew what a man of integrity he was, and also a more traditional, you know, figure. And that I also, you know, had a hand in helping Donald Trump win the Republican nomination when it came down to him and Ted Cruz. And I still don't care for Senator Cruz. And with that being said, I'm deeply disappointed, but I'll also say that Donald Trump has never represented Republicanism fully and thoroughly. He's always represented an offshoot and an element of Republicanism, true, but also I don't know that anyone would say that they are deeply convinced of Donald Trump's moral views, that they would say that he holds very strong personal positions on things like guns and abortion and some of the more traditional issues that Republicans have held to for the many decades. I think that Donald Trump was a larger-than-life figure, and that Hillary Clinton helped empower him due to her lack of capability and leadership just as much as Donald Trump's ability at communication and, you know, throwing in some punches and things like that. And so I think that Donald Trump may have had an opportunity to be a significant figure, but I think his actions over the last couple of months will have, as evidenced by the number of senators who withdrew their objections over the last 24 hours, I think that Donald Trump's endorsement, as it were, in 2022 interim races in 2024 will be greatly diminished by the actions of the last 60 days.
Yeah, and this is a consequence of his action is basically a consequence of his lack of character. And that brings me to another question. You know, when you watch Trump rallies, there are a lot of religious songs and prayers, Christians who pray, and you know, they have signs that says Trump, and then they have another signs that says Jesus or something like that. And you know, there are sort of a revival feeling, a Christian revival feeling in a lot of Trump rallies. So my question is, Trump, I don't think he's an evangelical Christian, but I think he champions evangelical values, but he's not a personal Christian. Why do you think so many, you know, evangelicals has basically supported him?
Well, I would say that there are three reasons for that. Mike Pence is a very noted and very authentic evangelical Christian political figure. And he has conducted the office of the vice presidency and his influence accordingly. I don't think that a single evangelical Christian won't praise Mike Pence's role within the administration. That being said, he is the vice president and not the president. And so I think that another reason that evangelicals have supported President Trump fairly consistently is because Donald Trump has, if perhaps more out of political pragmatism than deeply held belief, he has stood up for their issues and to a degree that, frankly, very few political figures in America have in the last 20 years. And so I do think that also his appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court, which were genuinely effective, thoughtful, genuine conservatives, has made them willing to forgive certain things and appreciate the work that he's done. And unfortunately, I would say that I think he took advantage of that trust at times.
Like I mentioned before, that there have been a lot of heroic Republicans basically that has stood against Donald Trump, and one of my favorites, whom I watched on YouTube a lot of times, is Gabriel Sterling from Georgia. And he's like, he works for the Secretary of State, and he's basically debunked Trump time after time. And I noticed that he's a big fan of Rush Limbaugh, and he basically says that Rush Limbaugh, he has been right in on everything except for, you know, the election outcome in Georgia. And I think he's really cool. And you know, could you mention some really cool Republicans with strong character that has, you know, taken a stand against Trump?
So it's interesting you mentioned Gabriel Sterling because he and I were in Young Republicans together 20 years ago.
Really? Wow.
Now, I won't try to say that we're best friends or anything, but we knew each other. And he was a smart, younger guy back then. And he's, grown into a very effective advocate, for what is ultimately a governmental responsibility, but he does, hold with it his own, personal values still. And of course, his boss, Brad Raffensperger, likewise, who is the Secretary of State and a Republican as well, in the state of Georgia, was an incredibly noted conservative state legislator previously to becoming Secretary of State, and was actually one of the very top, most conservative Republican members of the state Senate. And so, their worldview has been tried and tested for many, many years. And so I've been glad to see them in particular as it relates to the state of Georgia and just personally. But further on from that, I think that Senator Ben Sasse has been both thoughtful in the way that he described it and not just, kind of slamming on the buzzer because it was convenient. But he gave really thoughtful discussions and talks as well on some of these topics that we've been facing, both leading up to the election and, after the electoral results. I think, and your listeners will have heard me mention his name previously, Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who has been a noted conservative and especially a fiscal conservative of some remarkable strength over the last 20 years of his career, both in the House and the Senate. So I do think that there's room for holding out hope for a Republican Party beyond Trump and furthermore conservatism as it gathers its you know, forces in the march forward. That being said, I will say that I, as it relates to Georgia and how that affects the country, I was disappointed in Senator Kelly Loeffler's response and way of handling all of this. I think that both she and Senator David Perdue are both guilty of kind of the old Christian axiom, be hot or cold or I will spew you out. I think that their failure to make a moral determination is ironically the reason that they both lost. I think that, you know, Trump's casting of doubts certainly didn't help, you know, in the state of Georgia for some of his key supporters who probably didn't show up because they thought the elections were rigged, et cetera. But, you know, there is we tend to look back in history over the last 10 or 50 or 100 years, and the people who tend to stand out the most don't stand out for a party so much as they stand out for a willingness to, you know, light a torch and be counted when things weren't easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why we look to people like Winston Churchill. That's why we look to people like Teddy Roosevelt or Jack Kennedy or Ronald Reagan. And what's interesting about those people is it wasn't that they held their finger up in the wind to determine what 57.2% of people liked. They said, here is what's right and what I believe. And yes, a lot of people might agree with me numerically, but it may or may not win a poll-tested question in this particular moment. But when I explain myself and I explain it with a sense of moral clarity and righteous indignation, it's amazing how you can win the respect even sometimes of people who don't thoroughly agree with you.
Yeah.
And I feel like on that note, both Loeffler and Perdue let us down. And I think that's the reason they're both going to be former U.S. senators here in the next week.
Yeah, but since we're talking about Georgia, I'm very interested in this tape because I've been following you heard all the process in Georgia. So a couple of other questions about Georgia. Why was, you know, Georgia went further than any other state, I would say, to, you know, basically try to please Trump. They made a hand recount in Georgia, then made another recount, they made some audits. You know, they walked like 10 miles to please Trump and try to, you know, basically show him what had happened in Georgia. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And for those of us that, you know, follow politics, you know, very closely, you know, Brian Kemp has definitely been guilty of being a bit Trumpety, I guess. You know, in, for instance, the way they handled the coronavirus response, his was probably one of the most Trump-like responses, he and Ron DeSantis in Florida. And, you know, his brand of politics is much more in line with Donald Trump than, say, that of, you know, Lindsey Graham or Tim Scott or Ben Sasse or, you know, some of the other more perhaps mainstream Republicans. And so even so, you know, Trump, of course, we saw called for Brian Kemp's resignation. And that's when you start to realize that someone is not just holding a firm line, but is really just taking on anyone who stands against them. And that's not responsible politics at that point.
No, but if you would explain very briefly the division in Georgia in the Republican Party, because obviously we have the state government, the governor and the secretary and Gabriel Sterling on one side, and then we have the activists, the Trumpists, who basically believe everything Trump says. How could you basically describe the situation in Georgia?
Yeah, so I would say that as it relates to Georgia, Georgia is a very dynamic state. You know, there are some states that have almost a one-size-fits-all reality. You know, states like Wyoming, where there's not a town of more than 50,000 people in the whole state. So really, you've got rural and almost rural, you know, kind of situations. Whereas Georgia is also home to the largest city in the entire southern United States. Of Atlanta, and Atlanta is a predominantly African-American city. It is home to America's telecommunications system, corporations like AT&T and CNN, which, of course, your listeners will be well familiar with for their international prowess in news and information, and home to Delta Airlines and some Coca-Cola is headquartered in Atlanta, some major global corporations. And so you've got this massive city that's surrounded by a lot of rural small farming towns, especially in South Georgia, where people grow peanuts and cotton and pecans and peaches, and that's how they make a living. And so it's really two worlds colliding, along with the large universities and things like this. And so Georgia is a very dynamic state culturally. And you do have folks who are, you know, truly poor country folks and poor inner city folks, all the way up to some of the wealthiest and most powerful people who've ever lived in the history of the world, and everything in between. And so when you look at the Republican Party there, especially as it has become the predominant party of the state over the last 20 years, you have Republicans who look a lot more like Republicans from New York City, all the way to Republicans who honestly probably vote that way because of their positions on guns and abortion, and they probably don't think too much more deeply about politics than that, if I'm being honest. And their vote's still to be respected, and that's their right. But you know, one of the problems with Trump's brand of politics has been that he's not big on descriptions and details and or having a core philosophy. It tends to be a shoot from the hip, you know, type approach to politics. And those of us that have worked in politics and public policy know that they can get some things right, and certainly that their anger and frustration often comes from a very authentic and honestly genuine and valid place. But when you don't know the details and the history of government and the principles of constitutions, you know, sometimes that while you may have good intentions, you can find yourself walking down some pathways that can lead you places you don't want to go. And I think that that's some of what we've seen, unfortunately, really unleashed rather significantly at times by Donald Trump's rhetoric.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for taking time. This was very interesting. So thanks a lot, Justin.
Thank you so much, Ronnie. And again, Happy New Year to you and your listeners. And I do hope for better days, both for the United States and for all of the Western Alliance. And as we move forward into a world that certainly has a great many things to face in the years to come.
Indeed. Thank you. Det var avsnitt 1257 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, en konservativ podcast som finns för att ge det djupare perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd gärna på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom hemsidan på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat.